He is quite a sought-after speaker, apparently over 40 times a year, and I'm told he never misses a date. And again, due to disruption, he's a little late, but he's here. What I remember most of those Stephen, is the fact that he ran for the mayor of Brandon, back when we were serving a child. In fact, I did vote for you.
Woohoo!
Big Rick, but unfortunately, it didn't work for you. Anyway, I think we're not busy with time, so without further ado, please join me in welcoming Mr. Stephen Jones.
Well, thanks, everybody, and any other crowd would have left, so I really appreciate you hanging in there. My apologies for being late. It is true. This is my 222nd talk that I've given over the years. I've never missed one, and this is the second one to which I have been late. The first one was to the School of the Air in Alice Springs, Australia, and I arrived to that one an hour late, so, and they were still there, too. Because they had nowhere else to go. I want to begin by thanking Jeremy McDonald for the support that he's offered to me over the years, and also to Rick Hall, who's the conference organizer, also for the support he's offered to me over the years. A lot of the work that I've been able to do has been in large part due to the support of the people who are organizing this conference, and I clearly want to acknowledge that. This is not stuff that is created in isolation. It's stuff that's created in the context of work that I do with the people who are involved here and in Fredericton generally. I want to talk about providing learning and social networks, and I'm going to be a bit faster than anticipated, but I do hope to be able to finish on time. And but I'm not going to like speed it or speak at like time and a half speed. I'm going to still try to go, never mind, relax and do your talk. Okay, good.
You have an extra 10 minutes, because we're 10 minutes behind.
So. Oh, are we?
Yeah.
Oh, so. Bonus, I'm laughing. You know what, that kills me, because if I hadn't have tried to make arrangements because I was going to be late, I would have been on time. Life's little paradoxes. All right, so the first thing I want to do, I want to set my topic, which is social networks, into context, and that's especially important with respect to this conference. So I want to be very clear right off the bat. I love games. I love simulations. These things are incredibly cool, and not only cool, I completely acknowledge the role that games and simulations play in learning. If I were allowed to, I would spend the rest of the day in the helicopter simulation that's down the hall in this building and learning to fly a helicopter. I just love those things. Games and simulations have clear educational benefits, and in my mind, the benefit that they have is that they create environments that are immersive so that you are able to put yourself into something like an authentic experience. The idea of a helicopter simulation is that it's like flying a helicopter. So the experience that you're getting, the learning that you're getting, isn't just some sort of content stream or description or account with pictures of what it's like to fly a helicopter, but it's the actual immersive event in flying a helicopter. Other games are less immersive, but nonetheless offer this multifaceted experience. I'm thinking of, for example, games like EVE Online with these massive strategic maneuvers that they make, coordinating hundreds, thousands of players at the same time. You're not immersed in a simulated environment necessarily, but you are immersed in a simulated communications environment or a cooperation or collaboration environment where the people at the other end of the line are real. You can't beat that. Simulations and games, fabulous for learning. But we need to situate games and simulations within the wider context, and that's the topic of my talk today. Games and simulations, and for that matter, real life, are what might be called episodic. They happen, they stop. Well, you know, real life stops, never mind. I don't want to go there. But you know what I mean. Things happen, they end. Things happen, they end. You go out, you do something, it stops. You work on a simulation, it stops. What you want is to be able to connect these episodes together, to connect these experiences together, and to connect them with the episodes, with the experiences, of other people. And so what happens is, or no, not what happens, the way I would like you to see this is to see a wider context to games and simulations, a wider conversational, discourse-based context. Now, the thing with games and simulations, and the reason why we need this wider context, is that games and simulations need to be planned ahead of time. You saw the talk yesterday, I'm sure, in the morning, and I'm afraid I've forgotten and don't have written down the name of the person who gave the talk, but on games and simulations, I can tell you what time it was. One of the points that he wanted to make is that the learning objectives, the things that you are trying to pass on, are embedded in the game or in the simulation ahead of time. And this is typical of games and simulations. You know what you want to teach, you know how you want to teach it, and the whole purpose here is to design your game or your simulation in order to do that. However, we heard from Captain Jollymore yesterday that what we are educating for, and it's not just in a military context, it's in a life context generally, we are educating for the unknowns. We're educating for things we don't know about. We live in a world today that is complex and dynamic. Things that used to be true yesterday, like for example, Czechoslovakia was a country, are no longer true today. In addition, as General Haynes said, we need to understand what makes people tick. We need to be able to get into the minds of learners to understand what they need, what their expectations are, what they're looking for in their learning and in their experiences. So what we have here is a set of two phenomena, the changing unknown environment and the changing unknown users, that you cannot plan for and cannot build into a game or a simulation ahead of time. So we need that context setting, context building environment surrounding games that adapts and adjusts to these changing circumstances. Basically, the idea here is to create what may be called learning networks, to distribute the learning and to distribute the decision-making with respect to learning from the centralized designing source to, people who are in the field, people who are out there working or doing other things, and at that time have some need or have some expectation of some sort of learning. That was kind of an awkward sentence, but I think you know what I mean there. And what we want to do is, importantly, to create a learning system that actually learns. So that's kind of an obscure concept, so I want to talk about that ever so briefly. The idea here is we set up an environment. We set up an environment, a learning environment, and typically we think of a learning environment as an environment in which we're going to take some learning, whether it be a set of skills or whether it be some sort of content that we want people to learn, and we take that and we're going to send it out to people in the field. They're going to receive this input and they're going to learn this learning. However, in an environment where we don't know what we want to teach people because the situation is dynamic, the people are dynamic, we're not able to simply take that content and feed it out. So what we want to do is set up a system not only for the distribution of learning, but also a system that at the same time is able to learn about what it is that it needs to learn. A system that is able to detect, have experiences, respond, and pass on that kind of knowledge, that kind of information. So it's a learning system as well as a teaching system. Does that make sense? Looking, no nod, one nod, two nods, no shakes of the head. Okay. And again, to emphasize or to underline, we often don't know what it is we want to teach. And it sounds so ironic, doesn't it? But I think that this is true, especially in a rapidly changing dynamic environment. And I think you people here, most of all, deal with rapidly changing dynamic environments and probably have the most direct experience of this. But I don't think it is unique to your situation. I think that pretty much anyone working in a workplace today is subject to this rapidly changing and dynamic environment, which means that your learning systems must adapt. Your learning systems must learn what it is that they need to teach you. Now, an early began in about 2000, and many of you are familiar with this, I'm sure. An early approach to this was the Company Command online community. Company Command had several major propositions, one of which was that the knowledge exists in the minds of the participants. And again, this is the idea that the learning that you need to learn is out there at the edges. So the knowledge is in the mind of the participants out there in the edges. So what you want to do is to bring that knowledge back into the system. And so what happens is, as the people who are at the edges converse and interact for each other, the system learns. The need for content, the need for support, the need for learning emerges as a result of the conversations. It's not a nice, neat, direct causal process. It's not, you see something out there in the field, it happens that, oh yeah, I need to learn that. Rather, the conversation, the interaction back and forth is important to understand what it is that needs to be learned. I'm reminded by a lot of the discussions that take place on Yahoo groups, and in particular a paper by Aaron Brewer on beekeeping Yahoo groups. And typically what happens in a learning environment like that is, it's not simply somebody knows, somebody teaches what happens, but rather a person has a question, a need, they pose that question, they pose that need to the discussion board, and then instead of simple teaching, a negotiation occurs. The first response by somebody who is more of an expert or an authority is something like, well, why do you need to know? And the person who made the inquiry says, well, I'm trying to do such and such. And you can see the conversation goes back and forth. Eventually, some transfer of learning may happen. Eventually, this person, along with other people in the discussion area, may negotiate and find in that conversation a wider learning need. Or sometimes it transpires that the learning was not what they thought they needed at all. So it's not a simple cause-effect process. It's a complex process that requires this interaction and communication. Now, Drupal is an early attempt to create this sort of environment. Company Command, when it was first created, ran on the Drupal content management system. Drupal is a wonderful system. It's an open source content management system written in PHP, uses an open source database, and Drupal provides individual pages, individual accounts, discussion areas. It's a wonderful community management sort of tool. However, as time has gone by, we have found that content management systems such as Drupal are inadequate to the task of creating the dynamic sort of community that we want. In what has come to be called e-learning 2.0, we have found that people are applying social networking principles to these content communities. Social networking principles, for example, the creation of lists of friends with whom they communicate on a regular basis. Social networking principles, for example, the use of web-based software such as Google Documents or Flickr, the online photo hosting site, in order to manage their content. And so Drupal, which is a site-based content management system, by itself proves to be inadequate for this more complex communications environment. What we're seeing in e-learning 2.0 is a gradual shift, and I do emphasize gradual because this is something that's been happening now for a number of years, and it has not happened overnight, but a gradual shift to decentralization and linking. So instead of everybody coming to a Drupal system, people rather go to their own systems and create links between each other. And a lot of what e-learning 2.0 and a lot of what this discussion is about concerns the mechanics of such linking. A sort of second generation system that evolved was called ELG. And no, it doesn't stand for anything. It represents only the weird naming conventions in the minds of people like Dave Tosh. What ELG does is it combines content management as Drupal does with social networking. So people using Eld were able to create lists of friends with whom they connected. And then using those lists of friends and using external content systems, again, such as Flickr, YouTube, etc., they were able to use Eld in order to import and export content. So with a site like Eld, you're beginning to see this distributed approach. You're beginning to see the movement of information and content from one site to another site to another site. So that sets the context. That sets the stage for current developments in the field. So where we are now is what might be called a complex internet environment. And that's a good thing, because as the information that we're attempting to deal with out there in the field is complex, having a system that is complex in order to react to that, I would say, is most appropriate. What's happened is, back in the year 2000, 1999, 2000, people thought that communities would be like these destination resorts. That's the net.gain model. Net gain is a book written by Hegel and Armstrong, who came out of Harvard Business School, and they said the way the net will evolve is there'll be these communities, the travel community, the rutabaga community, the sports community, and people would flock to these communities. But what happened instead is people did not flock to these communities. They distributed their presence online. It's also not the web services model, and you've probably all heard the web services story. The web services story in the classic paradigm web services story is the travel example, where you decide you're going to travel somewhere, so you contact a travel agent and they use their web services to choreograph the hotel with the flight, with the car reservations and all of that. And that works really well in travel reservations, but for the messy, complex world of the web where you don't know what it is that you want and you don't know what service you'll be connecting to, the web services model has proven to be too rigid, too inflexible. Rather, what we have now is people have multiple home pages. And I put home pages in quotes because that's not really what it is. But what they do, and pretty much anyone who's using the web these days is doing this, is they put their data in multiple places. They put their blog on one of dozens and dozens of blog services. They may use Twitter or other forms of instant messaging, such as MSN messaging, ICQ, AOL messaging. I don't know if that exists anymore, but they may put their videos on YouTube or blip.tv or, again, another dozen others. Their photographs on Flickr or Picasa. They may use Google Mail or Hotmail. And I could go on, right? I could go on and on and on. You're all familiar with the many different applications that people use to store their content today. This is the current internet environment. Now, it's in that environment, and with that thought in mind, with that approach in mind, that George Siemens and I last fall decided to mount an online course. Now, an online course traditionally has the features of the Drupal website, has the features of a content management system where it's a destination resort. Everybody's going to come to your online course. All of the content will be in one place. The discussion will be in that place. It's the sort of learning management system approach to a course that you're all very familiar with. What Siemens and I decided to do was to adapt this distributed network picture, which I've just described, in the design of our online course. So instead of setting up the course as a single destination, we set it up as a series of distributed resources. So on a course wiki, we set up the outline of the course. On a separate course Moodle installation, Moodle, M-O-O-D-L-E, if you're not familiar with it, is an open source learning management system, we set up a discussion forum. We set up, in addition, a course blog, and in this course blog, George and I uploaded comments, observations, just blog-type kind of stuff. We also set up a newsletter, which acted as a daily reminder for members in the course of what was happening. We set up Illuminate discussions every Wednesday. and in combination with Dave Cormier and Jeff Lebo of Ed Tech Talk. And Dave Cormier, by the way, just lives over the ditch in Prince Edward Island. Yeah, I couldn't resist that. What they did, and if you don't know Ed Tech Talk, all one word, do go look it up. What they do is they use a Launchcast server, and they stream live audio over the internet. And they have a series of shows that they do. So what George and I did, along with Dave and Jeff, is we set up a Skype conversation. If you're not familiar with Skype, that's open, not open source, but free internet telephony. So we set up a conference call using Skype, and then Jeff funneled the audio output from that conference call into EdTech Talk's audio streaming services. And one of the outputs we had there was a Ustream stream of the online conversation. So the idea was we could have a conversation on Skype, and as many people as wanted to listen to it to listen to our conversation on Skype. And since it was a conference call, we can actually have people call us up just like a call-in show and have a conversation that way. So that was the model that we set out to use. But the other thing that we did is we made it an open course. It was a certificate course hosted by the University of Manitoba. So you could, if you wanted, pay tuition, get credit, all of that. And 22 or 24 people did that. But we also said all of the course content and all of the course teaching will be open. And we got about 2,200 people coming into the course. So this gave us a really good test of our infrastructure, which I might say performed beautifully. I was actually kind of surprised. So consequently, what happened and what we encouraged to happen was that the participants in this course created or built or grew, whatever verb you want to use, their own content network. What we asked people to do is we said to them, don't come to our stuff. Don't come to our wiki and set up a page. Don't come to our Moodle discussion and start discussing, although hundreds did. Set up your own presence somewhere out there on the internet and tell us about it. And that's what they did. We had, for example, 170 separate student blogs that were created, and there they are listed there. And what we did is we aggregated those blogs in order to create a single course feed, and I'll talk a bit more about that in a few moments. They also created their own Google Groups discussion areas, three separate areas on Second Life, two of which were in Spanish. They did their own Spanish translations for the course, and so on, more things that I can count, more things than I know of. And that was the other thing about this course, is that we tried to emphasize to students in the course, the idea here is not to consume everything in this course, because you can't. It's not possible. We, the instructors who actually know the field, cannot consume everything in the course. With 2,200 people taking the course, you cannot follow all the discussion, all the blogs, 170 blogs posting daily. How are you going to do that? The idea here is that you sample, you pick the things that seem interesting and relevant to you, that creates a certain perspective or a point of view on the material, and then you use that perspective or that point of view in order to interact and engage with the other people in the course. And it is out of that interaction and engagement that the knowledge that is produced in the course is actually created. And that's the neat thing about the Connectivist course. Although we had an idea of what we wanted to teach at the beginning of the course, and we outlined it on the wiki as this Connectivist curriculum, we did not know at the beginning of the course what it was we were going to be teaching in the course. What it was that we were going to be teaching would be created as a result of these interactions, as a result of people doing these things and bringing in their experiences. Now, oh, I seem to have gone ahead a slide. That's cool. In support of this course, and indeed in support of my own daily newsletter, which some of you are familiar with, I created an application called Grasshopper. And what Grasshopper is intended to do is to aggregate material from distributed online services, bring it together, provide an editing environment, and then to create output streams such as email newsletters or RSS feeds. Grasshopper is what might be called a prototype personal learning environment. And as you can see, although it's kind of smaller, but as you can see, the idea here is, again, it's bringing in content from various sources, giving you an editor screen, and then in the upper right there, various ways of outputting your content to different services. And if you think about it, the idea here is that it's an application that sort of floats in this web environment and links out to all the different services that you may be using. Links out to YouTube, links out to Flickr, links out to your blogging software. And so it gives you a mechanism for bringing together and working with all of your own distributed content sources, as well as those of other people who you may be in conversation with. It turns out, and this was completely accidental, Grasshopper is also an excellent teaching platform, because in a network sort of course, the actions of the teacher, the instructor, are very similar to the actions of the learner. The teacher and the learner will both be reading content, working with content, feeding the content forward. And so consequently, the same platform which accomplishes this will serve both of their needs. Now, interestingly though, what the teacher or the instructor is surveying or sampling is usually the work of the students. And so the role of the teacher in this sort of context is to survey and understand what the students are up to, what they're seeing, what they're creating, and then to try to find commonalities or patterns in that to pass on to the class as a whole. At least that's the mechanism that we employed in the Connectivism course. So Grasshopper, again, one of its major features is content aggregation and organization. And what you're seeing up there on the screen is its mapping screen, where it takes content from different sources and, according to properties of that content, organizes it and sorts it into different data fields or different data tables. It can, for example, assign automatically tags to that content. It can automatically distinguish event-based content from blog-based content, etc. This part of Grasshopper works very similarly to another application that you may have heard of out there in the field called Yahoo Pipes. And if you're not familiar with Yahoo Pipes, you may want to take a look at it. What Yahoo Pipes does is allow you to tap into, again, different content sources, filter them, organize them, sort them, and then create new output streams. In general, this kind of approach is called a mashup. The idea here is you're taking content from various sources and mashing it up. So Grasshopper is a mashup tool, Yahoo Pipes is a mashup tool, and in general, applications that support learning in a learning network are mashup tools. So that's the main structure of the work that we did, and now I'm sort of moving into some of the thoughts and lessons learned from that. And one of the lessons learned was with respect to evaluation. Now, when you're teaching a course where you don't know what the content is going to be ahead of time, it creates a bit of a challenge for evaluation, because you can't simply test them on recall of the course content. Rather, your evaluation of not just the students who are in the course, but of the effectiveness of the course itself is going to be based on a wider range of criteria. I'm not going to say that I have this wider range of criteria nailed down. Right? Honestly, I don't think anybody has this wider range of criteria nailed down. But it's going to be an evaluation based on competence and contribution, and not memory. And what I mean by that probably is demonstrations of a person's critical capacities, demonstrations of a person's ability to recognize important patterns, demonstrations of a person's contribution to the course through interaction, participation, etc. these sort of metrics are going to become more important, I would say, than memory metrics. Another aspect that we noticed as we delivered this course was the idea of distributed evaluation. This was something that occurred quite by accident. We didn't expect it and plan for it, but it happened. With 2,200 people in the course, obviously we were not evaluating everybody. Nobody has time for that. And indeed, we're only evaluating the 24 people who had signed up, paid fees, registered, and were going to get course credit from the University of Manitoba. But what we did find is we had a student from Israel who wanted to take the course and do all of the assignments, but this person would not submit the assignments to us for grading. This person would submit the assignments to their own supervisor for grading. And, you know, needless to say, George and I were very happy to have that happen, because that meant somebody else could get graded and we wouldn't have to do anything, which was very high on our list of priorities. But it also did suggest to us a mechanism whereby you could offer a single, large, complex, multifaceted course and have multiple distributed evaluations take place of that same course material from different evaluation agencies and according to different evaluation criteria. And if someone can help me here, this is my plug.
I was gonna say, I don't have an Apple plug.
You don't need an Apple plug, you just need an electrical plug. if you just plug that somewhere, and that will prevent the presentation from going boom on us.
Just keep talking.
Yeah, I'll just keep. Thanks a lot. So that leads me to some future considerations, and
interaction.
That was definitely interaction. I want to emphasize that now these future considerations are more speculative on my part, more projective on my part, and not as well tested. But nonetheless, I think that they follow pretty reasonably and logically from the work that's been done so far. One piece of work that I've been doing is something called serialized feeds. This comes from the realization that in September, we're going to offer the Connectivism course again. And one of the things that characterized my work in the Connectivism course last year was getting up at 6:30 every morning and creating the daily feed. Now, I know you guys are all up at 6:30 every morning. I don't want to be if I can possibly avoid it. So what I want to do is to automate that process as much as I can. And so what a serialized feed is a system whereby you set up all the content of the course, all the content that you know about, you set that up ahead of time, and then you plug that into the RSS feed for the course. The idea here is that you're going to take some predefined content and mix it and merge it on the fly with content that was created last night. So what you're doing is feeding predefined content into your dynamic live stream. It's kind of like, you know, the way somebody working in radio, they'll do live radio, they'll interview their guests, whatever, but they'll take some tapes and slip the tapes into the broadcast as well, that sort of thing. So the serialized feed system is an effort to do this. So the idea here is a serialized feed. The idea is you predefine the content, you give it what I call an offset or a certain number of days from the beginning of the course, and that offset determines when the material will be released. I've got a demo of that on my website at course.downs.ca. It's kind of marginally functional at the moment, but it's one of these projects that I'm working on, so it'll get better over time. Another piece of work that's coming up is something called the Personal Learning Environment, and this is an actual NRC development project. We're assigning staff and resources to this, and the structure of the Personal Learning Environment will be to take the prototype core Grasshopper code and transform it into something that is a lot more robust, a lot more commercially viable. The basic structure of a project or of an application such as this is to give you this floating platform that allows you to connect to all the different resources. Where it says future VLE up there on that chart, and this is the classic Scott Wilson PLE diagram, where it says future VLE, insert the letters PLE, and that is where the personal learning environment is situated, and then it connects to all of these external content sources, Flickr, YouTube, etc., but not just these services that are out there on the web, but also these services that are hosted by learning institutions or learning providers. And the idea too is that the serialized feed would be one of those cloud bubbles and would feed into your personal learning environment. So the personal learning environment basically works on four major stages. The first stage is to aggregate or to bring content in from other sources, whatever those sources may be over the internet. It brings those in according to predefined content protocols such as RSS or ATOM or application-specific APIs, application program interfaces. Then, secondly, to remix this content, and what that means is to take content from multiple sources and put it together in the same environment. Then, thirdly, to repurpose that content. And this is where you are adding your own input to the content, you're shaping it, you're localizing it, you're adding your own experience, your own examples, you're converting the vocabulary of that content to words that you use, etc. And then finally, feeding forward of that content, distributing that content over your network to either a set of subscribers to your RSS feed, subscribers to your Twitter feed if your content is really short, or people who have subscribed to your email newsletter. The idea here is that a personal learning environment creates a network and not merely a learning management system. And this is because this is a fundamental paradigm shift. I just want to draw this out a little bit. Again, keep in mind, with a learning management system, there's a learning management system, that's my hand, everybody goes to the learning management system. The personal learning environment, you have your personal learning environment, your friend has their personal learning environment, your other friend has their personal learning environment, each person has their own personal learning environment. Each personal learning environment is configured slightly differently according to the needs and interests of that person. And then connections exist between these personal learning environments, and that's what creates the network. So it's a distributed form of learning. And you might be asking now, as learning providers, how you fit into this. You are, as a learning provider, one node in this network. You are like another person in this network of personal learning environments, and you are sending communications out to other members in the network, other members who have chosen or opted to receive your communications. Now, just to take this back a step and up a step, the model now of learning is beginning to change. The model of learning content is beginning to change. For those of you who cut your teeth, and there may be some of you who cut your teeth on things like learning objects and learning content and learning manuals, what's happening is that our understanding of what this content is like is changing from something where we're dealing with content to something where we're dealing with objects. Right, that was really badly phrased, but I'll try to make this a bit clearer. The picture here, the palm tree and the horse, is intended to represent an approach to learning where we think of learning as happening in an environment and where the learning resources are not assembled together like bricks or Legos or atoms, but rather where they're standalone, like a palm tree and a horse. And they may not be designed for each other in any way. Palm trees were not designed to interface with horses. Horses were not designed to interface with palm trees. But in an environment, given certain capacities for both palm trees and horses can interact. And the idea here is that learning content works this way as well. Learning content is not something we assemble into a book, sentences, chapters, books. Rather, learning content, each item of learning content is standalone, like a palm tree, like a horse, and interacts with or interfaces with other elements of learning content. Does that make sense? It's kind of a weird way of looking at content. But where this comes from, this idea comes from, first of all, the concept of object-oriented programming, and then secondly, from multi-user, they're originally called multi-user dungeons, MUDs, which are online games, online environments. And the idea, the way a MUD was created is the entire MUD is defined as a software object. And then inside that software object, you have other objects, which are rooms. And then inside those rooms, you have other objects, which are players or monsters or gates or whatever. And then these things that are inside the rooms might interact with each other. These objects interact with each other. A player, for example, can enter a room. Or a player, if it's in the same room as a monster, can say, kill monster. And then monster will react by killing player, because monsters are often... Anyhow. But to get the idea here is that each one of these, a room, a monster, a player, is a bit of predefined content. And this bit of predefined content interacts with itself in an environment. So the idea here now is that we can move from an approach to content where content is organized in courses, where it's organized in lessons and activities, where it's organized as a flow chart, the way we would see in a typical learning design application, to something which might be called state-based learning design, where we think of content as interacting, content as existing, free-floating in an environment. It may be brought into the environment by a person. It now floats around in this environment and communicates with people or communicates with other content. I really wish I was explaining this better, but this is my first go at trying to explain this, so I hope you're a little bit patient with me. Yeah. So, maybe less than 5 minutes. The barbarians are at the gates. So, in state-based learning design, learning content, bits of learning material, are two things at the same time. The first thing that they are is, if you will, a word in a conversation. They are like a word in a conversation. The second thing they are is entities in an environment. Now let me connect this with the model of network learning that I've been talking about so far. You have people, whoever they are. They're out there in the world. They have their own their own personal learning environment. They interact with people online, but they interact with the world. This is the key thing. People aren't just working on the computer. They're taking pictures of things. They're recording videos. They're jotting down their observations. Each one of these things, the video, the photo, the observation, becomes an object. This object becomes a way that this person can converse with other people in the network. The person takes a photo, that creates this word. This word is fed into the network. Now this word becomes free-floating in the network. This word, this picture, interacts with other people. This word, this picture, becomes joined to other things, becomes part of larger objects. The idea here is that learning takes place by manipulating and working with these objects in an environment. By working with and manipulating these objects in an environment, you're immersing yourself in this environment. You're immersing yourself in the communications that are taking place from people who are out in the field. It gives you a perspective or a point of view, not necessarily of one particular person out there, but of persons out in the field generally. just a few final words, and that's the end of that topic. I just want to say a few final words on openness, and that's in particular to this audience, although I find schools, colleges, universities, the main reaction when I talk about open networks such as this, the first question that comes up is always security. That question always comes up, always comes up. And the reaction of people typically in order to create a secure environment is to lock stuff down. And I want to argue that that's probably the wrong reaction to take. My own belief, my own experience, is that walls do not create security. Now, people who want security very often build walls, but you know, what I've seen is the people who are behind walls tend to be more afraid than the people who are out there in the community. The wall has not actually created a condition of security for them. Rather, in my view, what has happened is that the wall has created a point of weakness for them, because when that wall is breached, now whatever is behind that wall is vulnerable because it was designed to be behind the wall. My own view with respect to security is that security exists in robust systems that can operate even when all aspects of the system are known. When all aspects of the system are known and the system can still function, then that system is more robust than a system that must run behind the wall. Now that's very airy-fairy theoretical, but the real world example of this is the contrast between the way Microsoft writes code and the way the open source world writes code. The way Microsoft writes code is it's created this wall, this operating system, and it always assumes that whatever content, whatever data is coming in is the right data. And if it's not the right data, if it's, say, 200 bits instead of 150, and it does an overflow, then the system becomes vulnerable. On the other hand, in open source code, you don't know what's coming in. You have no idea what's coming in. So in any open source application, the very first thing you do is you check your data and you make sure that the data that you're working with is the data that you wanted, and then you do things for specific bits of data, and if the data isn't the data that you expected, you ignore it. You don't do anything with it. So the idea here is that the open code tends to be more secure because the open code does not make assumptions that the closed code does. Anyhow, that's just me thinking aloud. You can take that or leave that as you wish. I'm not an expert in security, and I don't even play one on TV. So that's my talk. Questions? I love how you knew the last slide was coming up.
Hey, Steve, thanks for that. That was fun. So, on evaluation, and your 2,200 students in the Connectivism course, were they students or were they clients? Were you a teacher or a consultant? Are they getting a mark or an outcome? So I kind of see a move away from standardized, and you're clearly in transition with 24 students getting a mark. But on the other side, I think, client, consultant, outcome, but that's not a bad model either.
No, it's not a bad model, actually. And, I would say that the answer to that question is, each individual student is either a client or a student, right? Each individual either has a mark or an outcome. But there isn't a single term that can describe all 2,200 people in the course, that the relationship between each person and each, and there aren't even necessarily single instructors. Like, it was George and I, but then we brought in Dave and Jeff, and we brought in other people.
I started using facilitator even rather than consultant.
Yeah. So, I think it's a wider model than just teacher-student. I think it works as a wider model, and I think that's part of its strength.
One more?
Don't make me choose.
The idea to run that course one more time and use the data that's in there in some way?
Yeah. All of the material that we produced last fall is still there, and indeed, if you guys want to see this, it's in Connect, C-O-N-N-E-C-T, .downs.ca. Everything is in there. We're going to use that very same environment. We'll flush the list of people, the list of emails, and create, well, flush is a bad word, maybe. Purge? No, that's a bad, you know what I mean. So we'll create a new list of participants.
We'll graduate them.
Yeah, we'll graduate them. That's it. We'll create a new list of participants, but we'll use all of the old content, and we'll be building on it, of course, with new content.
We've got to get some handsome people out there with four rings.
What do you say to the military hierarchy that says this is fine for education, where there's not defined outcomes in the training? We need something. We can't rely on the students to have the intelligence to find out what it is that they need to know.
Sure. Well, yeah. This is why I tried to draw from some of the quotes from yesterday's conversation. I think that people who are higher up in the military hierarchy get there because they understand that they don't have all the answers. Certainly, we know that they don't have all the answers. People who are higher up in the hierarchy depend on regular, timely, and accurate information from the field, and then feed back as well as possible their beliefs, their opinions, and yes, their commands. That's still a network environment, right? It's a network environment in which some participants in the network are more privileged, but what's key, and what's especially key in a rapidly changing environment, is that the communication in this network flows in multiple directions and not in a single direction. And so, you know, I haven't done away with generals, but I've repurposed them in this model.
Well, Stephen, I can't say for sure if I'm... Again, I don't know if soldiers and philosophers were designed to interact either, but in this case it worked quite well. So on behalf of the group, thanks very much.
Thanks a lot.
Right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks for staying around.